This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
We talk movies every Friday afternoon. Mark's decided to take another week off, it being half term or some flimsy excuse like that. Delighted to say we have reunited the much loved pairing, Boyd and Floyd, which is Boyd Hilton and Nigel Floyd. Gentlemen, how are you?
Very well. Very excited to be in the same room as Sparks.
How about that?
Incredible. Yes, did you ask them about their Morrissey song?
Yes, because you had Johnny Marr on right at the beginning of the concert, so there's a brief Morrissey That's conversation, which has been pretty good, actually. So, movies, what are the new movies of the week? We'll do the top ten in just a moment, but what will we be getting to before 4 o'clock?
We've got the excitement of Michael Jackson.
Yeah, we're very excited about Michael Jackson, obviously.
I think Boyd might be more excited than
I went to the premiere at 1 a.m. on Wednesday
Why
night.
Why was it 1 a.m?
Because it was LA, they did it globally, so it started everywhere, simultaneously around the world. So LA time, it was 6 o'clock or whatever, and we had to put up with 1 a.m.
All right, so the Michael Jackson film, what else?
First up is Nine, and then An Education, scripted by Nick Hornby. We'll be coming to that a bit later on. And then we've got a Danny Dyer movie later on. Lovely.
No, we don't have to do impressions. This week, we can be
let's not
impressions-free. So let's do a box office top 10. First of all, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs at number 10. Let me just do an email on this. First of all, this is Luke Barnard. On the Good Doctor's recommendation, went to see Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs with my girlfriend and 8-year-old brother in 2D. One of the funniest kids' flicks in years, enjoyed thoroughly by all three of us, even better than Up, in my opinion. Also saw that in 2D, especially like the scene with the roast chickens, which paid homage to Aliens and the infinite Star Wars references. It'll be on my Christmas list for everyone if it's come out on DVD. Also, he said, you might like to know, I work for Newbury Council, says Luke. And in the anything to add comments box, the resident survey that we hand out, a sure fan of yours has put in the anything to add box, hello to Fairport Convention and hello to Jason Isaacs. I just thought you might like to know. Luke Barnard, thanks very much indeed. So, Cloudy.
That means we don't have to do that. We don't have to say hello to Jason Isaacs.
No, we don't have to do that.
David Morrissey. It is one of the funniest computer animated cartoons of recent years. It's not better than Up, though. That's madness. But it is brilliantly enjoyable and funny.
I haven't seen this movie, a film that's better than Up is a tough ask.
Yeah, it's incredibly enjoyable, and I do urge anyone who hasn't seen it with children must take them to see it.
Fame's at 9.
Nigel hasn't seen this either, so I'll go on Fame. Fame is disappointing. The original is a really good film, and this one's had all the edges rounded off. But 10-year-old girls will love it.
Zombieland at 8.
Yeah, Zombieland. I noticed the Good Doctor was comparing it last week unfavourably to Shaun of the Dead. Let's get this straight about Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead is a 30-minute TV sitcom stretched out to about 100 minutes. And is not funny and not scary.
You're wrong. I'm totally with Dr. Kermit. Shaun of the Dead is one of the greatest films of the last 10 years. Mm. How about that? Greatest comedies.
Zombieland is not.
There's only one
of the
way to sort that out. Harry has to have a fight.
Zombieland is okay. I mean, it's not really a zombie movie. It's more of a buddy movie, as we said the last time we were on. Surprising that it's sort of hanging in there at the bottom of the top 10, because I thought it would slip away.
The Invention of Lying's at number 7. Kevin and E. Sheen saying, I'd like to question the default criticism of The Invention of Lying that it's not funny enough, as I think it's exactly as funny as it wants to be. The first half is a fairly knockabout comedy, which helps the viewer understand and appreciate the world in which the film is set. However, as most people have pointed out, the laughs dry up in the second half when Ricky becomes the Christ-like figure. Well, I'm not quite sure you'd want to describe it like that. Maybe the Antichrist-like figure. I believe that's because this half of the film is supposed to be more dramatic. It isn't meant to be funny.
I think that's probably true. I interviewed Ricky Gervais, and he said he insisted the second half wasn't supposed to be that funny, and he said he doesn't like films that are funny all the way through. I would point to the great Woody Allen films that are funny all the way through and manage to be moving and interesting, but I think he deliberately wanted the second half to be more dramatic. I've seen it twice, and I enjoyed it much more the second time. I do think it's good, but not as good as Ghost Town.
The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus at number 6.
You haven't seen this one. Have you seen this?
I have stayed away from it, quite honestly. I've got to the point now with Terry Gilliam where, you know, I do not share the Good Doctor's enthusiasm for his
He said last week that everyone should have all of Terry Gilliam's films on DVD. All of them. Well, can I just say, if anyone sat through this a second time, they deserve some kind of prize, because I thought it was quite tedious and very disappointing.
I mean, the problem with watching these more recent films is it takes away from your enjoyment of the earlier ones, because you think back to Time Bandits in Brazil and you think it was all there, and then you come to the later stuff and you think, do I need to see another one of these, because it's just besmirching my memory.
I have to say, it's good to see it doing well, though, because it is a very ambitious, interesting, challenging film. It just doesn't work.
Cirque de Freaks at number five.
Oh, my God. I saw this the other night. I paid money to see it. This is, my nephew loves these books. So these are the Darren Shan books. They're hugely popular among 8, 9, 10-year-old boys, and they are wonderful. This film is a disgrace to humanity. It's a terrible, lifeless mess of a film, and I urge kids who love the books, don't ruin it by seeing this film.
Speaking of which, Couples Retreat at number four.
Oh, dear, dear, oh, dear. Well, it's, you know, there was a film in there somewhere, if only they could have found it. But unfortunately, they just kind of wandered around it, and they never found anything funny in it at all.
On the subject of Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is this week's number three, Hannah Elizabeth from Callens in Warrington. I'm 12 years old. I think this came in as a result of the fact that Mark last week was saying that middle-aged people will like it, hence critics loving it, but that kids won't. Hannah Elizabeth saying, I'm 12, and after listening to your review of Fantastic Mr. Fox, I went in not expecting to understand anything. I was, however, pleasantly surprised that I got all the jokes. I particularly enjoyed the one on existentialism. Hannah Elizabeth, you 12? Are you certain about that? And the Jarvis Cocker song. Despite all this, I still thought it was overly academic and arrogant. Love the show. My English teacher thinks you're great. How many 12-year-olds would use the word existentialism, would you think? I mean, I think that Hannah Elizabeth is extremely bright.
I think I tried to read Sartre when I was about 13 or 14, being an obnoxious little tyke.
James in Barnstable. I took my 14-year-old and 8-year-old to Fantastic Mr. Fox. I really liked it. I'm a big Wes Anderson fan. I thought, great old-style stop-motion animation, great script and voices. It reminded me a bit of Chicken Run. I didn't think it was just lots of talking at a level that kids wouldn't understand all the time, as Mark said. My 14-year-old loved the design. My 8-year-old leant over partway through and said, how much longer has it got to go? But he said this because he needed the toilet and he didn't want to miss anything. Ooh. So there, Mark. The last few Pixar films, he got bored in the middle. He didn't with Fantastic Mr. Fox. Go and watch it a second time, Mark. I think you're missing something.
I don't think so. I mean, Mark's problem with the film last week seemed to be that that it's not a children's film. And my problem with the film is that it is a Wes Anderson film. And like all Wes Anderson films, it is arrogant, smug and unfunny.
I have a theory that people kids who have no interest in who directed this film do enjoy it. Because I've heard other 10, 11, 12-year-old kids who have enjoyed this film.
Number two, which is Saw 6. And Nigel, you've seen Saw 6. Lucky
Saw 6,
man.
In brief.
So we don't have to.
It's not as bad as 5, but not by much. That's pretty much what
we do. The UK's number one is Up. And some correspondence on this. Ben and Gates said, I have to disagree with Floyd and Boyd about the relative merits of Up and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Meatballs is an hour and a half of madcap hysterical genius, whereas Up is 30 minutes of wonderful, heartwarming, tear-inducing brilliance, followed by an hour of wildly irritating talking dogs with squeaky voices. It has the same problem as Wall-E in that Pixar seem to have a fantastic initial premise, which they exhaust in the first half of the film, and then get stuck as to how to move it forward convincingly and end up padding it out for an extra hour. Anyway, as you were, says Ben. This from Phil Henwood, saying, right, can we end this 3D nonsense here and now? I have seen Up in both 2D and 3D formats, 2D first, and watching it in 3D added nothing to the experience. There was no feeling of extra depth or indeed anything extra, just a headache from the glasses. Can we now discard 3D to the Disney theme parks where it surely belongs and leave cinema to go back to making films where you don't have to pay an extra 10 New Zealand dollars, 25% for a family of four, for the privilege? This is Phil, by the way, an Auckland resident, BSc Honours Biological Sciences. I would say I'm never going to pay to see a 3D film again, but the 3D Toy Stories are out here soon, and I guess the only way my children, Rebecca and Ben, will ever get to see these on the big screen is by parting with my hard-earned cash.
I'm in complete agreement about that your correspondent about the 3D Up. I saw it in 2D and 3D, and the 3D didn't add anything at all. Unfortunately for him and everyone else who hates 3D, Avatar is about to hit us in before Christmas, which is James Cameron's 3D thing, and a new trailer is out yesterday, and it still looks like a Yes album cover brought to life as far as I'm concerned. But back to Up.
Yes, Up. I'm starting to come round to the Good Doctor's position actually about Up, which is that yes, that the first sort of 20 minutes, half an hour is incredibly good, And then once you get to the sort of disgraced explorer and the mechanical dogs, it does all get a bit wackier and a bit stranger and a bit more bonkers. And then it pulls itself round again at the end. So, unfortunately, I've had to sort of shift my ground on that one.
Just one more here from Simon. Last weekend, I took my three-year-old on his first trip to the cinema to see Up, his first experience of watching a film at home being The Wizard of Oz. He loved it, and it was, for me, a near religious experience as I imagined the many cinema trips to come. Finally, I can start enjoying being a parent. Can any future visit compare to this wonderful film, though? I haven't cried that much since my last urethral swab, he adds, unhelpfully. Can I suggest a new theory in the style of the six laughs makes a great comedy rule? Any film that brings you to tears three times is a classic. I know any old saccharine-filled schmaltz can raise tears once, but three times seems to be a real achievement. Now, I would suggest an addendum to the rule. Three cries during a film doesn't count if you're overly susceptible due to some great personal trauma.
That's a great theory. Also, how quickly will it make you cry as well? Because some people cry during the first 10 minutes of Up. But I do agree that if you cry three times in a film, that's pretty impressive.
Anyway, that's the box office top 10. Some new stuff, and we'll start with 9.
Well, talking of computer animated films, 9 is one. It started out as a kind of short. It was Oscar-nominated a few years ago by this newcomer, Shane Acker, and they've turned it into a 90-100-minute film. Tim Burton slapped his name on it as a producer, so it's kind of got, you know, very interesting background. It's set, as many, many films are these days, in a post-apocalyptic world, a nightmare world where all no humanity seems to exist anymore, but there are these strange little things that are kind of mechanical but look like rag dolls. And they're all numbered on the back, and 9 is one of them. Let's hear a clip.
Where's 8?
That thing has them. It's taking them back to the machine.
Then it's too late. We have to get out of here. We must try to find another safe place.
No more hiding. We're going after them. All of us.
Need I remind you of the outcome of your last heroic venture?
I can't let this happen to them.
That was Christopher Plummer as number one. And he is, very interesting kind of imagery in this film, that he looks like, he's kind of dressed almost as a bishop carrying a staff, and there's a lot of it, their base is in a church of the kind of surviving little creatures, and he's the one who tries to keep them all in the church and won't let them go out. He's a bit of a dictator. Interesting religious imagery. Mm-hmm. I won't say any more at this stage. And the little funny little guy speaking was Elijah Wood, and he's the kind of likeable hero, but slightly banal hero, I would say. And he's the one who wants to go out into the world, try and find other survivors, and try and kind of work out why there's this ravenous beast thing that's also mechanical, hunting them down. But I have to say, my first thing I'm going to say, well, I don't know what Nigel's looking at me like I'm about to say something really important, is it's just not that exciting. The original 10-15 minute short, fantastic. It looks beautiful. It looks a bit like the first 10 minutes of Wall-E. It has that kind of bleak, very brown and grey look to it. And I imagine when the filmmakers saw Wall-E, they were like, oh my God, we've done an entire film looking like this. And then they kind of set in a similar world. But I have to say, after about 15-20 minutes, I was bored.
It is quite dull. And it's strictly speaking, if you take the credits out, it's 75 minutes. But what it is an 11-minute short that's been stretched out to 75 minutes. There just isn't the material to warrant stretching it out to that length. And part of the problem is that there's sort of two things going on. One is that they've all banded together and the young upstart 9 is trying to persuade them to sort of act for the common good and somehow, two things, unravel the mystery of their own creation, which may be the key to their survival, and also somehow sort of put together the remains of this world so that it's not sort of just goes into complete annihilation. But the problem with that is they're just these kind of little animated dolls made out of sacking and scrap metal. They're about 8 inches high, which presumably means that smaller children should identify with them a little more. But it's a 12A movie, and it wants to sort of satisfy both camps, but it's not really sure where it is.
Why is it a 12A?
Well, that's an interesting question, but it seems to be for adults, as far as I can make out, or at least for kind of 15, 16-year-olds and up. Because it has a lot of kind of very adult dialogue, it has a lot of violence in terms of machine-on-machine violence, but nevertheless kind of big, exciting action sequences that could be distressing for younger kids. But it is a bit bizarre that it's 12A. I thought it could have been PG, really. But it does seem to be aimed primarily at adults, and yet it's not nearly sophisticated, witty, clever enough, really, to interest adults for 90 minutes. It's actually the dialogue's kind of banal. It just shows you, I kept thinking, it just shows you how brilliant the Pixar films are, because it's so hard to do these films that appeal to adults and maybe children. I don't think this one's particularly even trying to appeal to children, but it doesn't really capture your imagination like any of the Pixar films.
It sounds like it might fall in between a number of stories, yeah. Nigel.
It does, it does. I mean, the problem is it would like to be to have that kind of simple storytelling that you have in the Pixar movies, but what it is a big, clunking, allegorical, with a capital A, universal, with a capital U, attempt to kind of give you this grand idea. And that's not how Pixar work. You know, they take a little idea, and then you find the universal in it. They've taken a big universal idea and tried to scale it down.
It
doesn't
work. Is it preachy?
It is.
It's very preachy. And the ending is quite distressingly preachy.
Tony in South Norwood, dear Wilson, Keppel and Betty, thank you for reading the correspondence from your 12-year-old listener. Her reference to a joke about existentialism confirmed to me that I did indeed fall asleep during the film. Andy in London, Up is fab. How can you not love a film that has the squirrel line and the dog's behaviour and the I hid under your porch because I love you line? It is weird but wonderful. I will be buying it. Dear Locums and Simon, Shaun of the Dead is not a half-hour sitcom stretched into 120 minutes, says Chris Nealon, comedy writer and film critic for Film International magazine. And here's why. In the episode of Space to which Floyd referred, the zombies are only a minor part of the narrative. A sea strand, if you will, cropping up in about three scenes. For Shaun of the Dead, this concept of throwing mundane, everyday characters into an extraordinary genre situation is expanded upon and absolutely applied to a cinematic narrative with the cinematic character arcs, emotional journeys and appropriate narrative structure. Get it right, Floyd.
You tell him. You should.
That's what he said.
We should say that Edgar Wright, director of Shaun of the Dead, does listen in as well, because he tweeted about Dr. K's comment on the film last week, thanking him.
All right, well, we'll say hello to Edgar.
Yeah.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk, new movie coming out this week. One, I think it was The Times, actually, this morning, gives it 5 stars out of 5. We'll find out what Boyd and Floyd make of it. This is an education.
Yes.
Nobody does anything worth doing without a degree. Nobody does anything worth doing with a degree. No woman, anyway. So what I do isn't worth doing, or what Miss Stubbs does, or Mrs. Wilson, or any of us here. Because none of us would be here without a degree. You do realise that, don't you? And yes, of course, studying is hard and boring.
Boring?
I'm sorry?
Studying is hard and boring. Teaching is hard and boring. So what you're telling me is to be bored, and then bored, and finally bored again, but this time for the rest of my life. This whole stupid country is bored. There's no life in it, or colour, or fun. It's probably just as well the Russians are going to drop a nuclear bomb on us any day now, so my choice is to do something hard and boring, or to marry my Jew and go to Paris and Rome and listen to jazz and read and eat good food in nice restaurants and have fun. It's not enough to educate us anymore, Miss Walters. You've got to tell us why you're doing it.
It doesn't have to be teaching, you know. There's a civil service.
Got the whole scene there playing right. That's right towards the end of the film as well. An education. Just set up what we were listening to there, and the, tell us the story on that night.
Well, the story in brief is that the fantastic performance by the 24-year-old Carey Mulligan,
who we heard there arguing with Emma Thompson,
indeed, who plays a precocious 16-year-old schoolgirl called Jenny. Now, she and in particular her parents had plans for her to go to Oxford University and make something of herself. Unfortunately, these get derailed when she gets into a romance with a rather charming but slightly sleazy older man called David, played by Peter Sarsgaard. And interestingly enough, he seduces both the 16-year-old schoolgirl and her parents. And she, in turn, is seduced because she enters a world where she goes out to classical music concerts, she stays out late, goes out to restaurants, which she's never really done before, gets invited away for a weekend in Paris, which is where it all starts getting a little bit murkier, and then the whole tension is therefore set up. Now, what's odd about this film is it started out as a memoir by Lynn Barber, who is an observer journalist of some years. She was looking back at her teenage self with a slight sense, I think, of, you know, her incredible naivety. How on earth could I have been that naive? How could I not have seen through him? The film, which has been scripted by Nick Hornby, kind of shows you it from the other end. It shows you a teenage girl completely wide-eyed, stumbling into this relationship with this guy who probably isn't everything that he says. So there's a sort of an interesting shift there. And it's interesting they should choose someone like Nick Hornby, who, of course, you know, is one of the great sort of champions of Lad Lit, mm-hmm. and wrote High Fidelity and Fever Pitch and so on. But I think he's done a terrific job. If I have a problem with the film, and I do, it is that the edges have been knocked off it, and it is a little bit too soft for me.
There's a moment, Boyd, at the beginning of the film, right at the very beginning, where Peter Sarsgaard, in a very, very flash and lovely sports car, drives over. This is the first encounter of the two, and every person, certainly every parent, is going to be looking at that going, don't talk to him, just walk on. And he looks exactly like Ed Balls. So, you know, if a guy who looks like Ed Balls in a sports car comes on over all smooth, you need got to run away.
Never get into a car with anyone who looks like Ed Balls is the lesson to learn. He brilliantly, the clever thing he does, though, is drives along next to her while she's walking along the street. That's his cunning way of showing trust. He has various other ways of showing trust. I absolutely love this film, I have to say. Let's just think about it. How often do you get a film coming along that's kind of a romantic comedy, a little bit, but so sophisticated, clever, witty, beautifully filmed, incredibly acted. I mean, I have to say, Kerry Mulligan, who plays the main character, plays the Lynn Barber figure, who's called Jenny. She's been compared to Audrey Hepburn because she looks a bit like her and she has that incredible charm. She is phenomenal. The Doctor Who fans will recognise her from Blink, one of the best ever Doctor Who stories. She was the main character in that episode, and loads of fans, including me, wanted her to be the new companion for the Doctor. Unfortunately, it never happened. Clearly, she was going on to greater things, to this thing, which is absolutely phenomenal. I loved every minute of it, and it made me cry, I think, kind of almost once, and certainly fully for the second time. And there's one scene which summed it up for me, the scene where she goes back after the best night of her life, which is the first night she goes out with these sophisticated people to a jazz club and stuff. She goes back and she sees her mum waiting for a clear, still doing the washing up. It's a beautifully underplayed scene. And her mum says, how wasn't it? She says, it was the greatest night of my life. And her mum is kind of sad because she clearly hasn't had any experiences like that in her life. And that just summed up how kind of subtle yet fantastic this film is. I don't think it should be underestimated.
A word about Alfred Molina, who puts in a great performance, doesn't he? As the dad who is sort of, he's a control freak, but he realises as the movie progresses that he really hasn't been a great dad.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? And only Alfred Molina, I think, could have pulled this off, because a lot of the humour is very, very broad. And I felt that slightly capsized the movie in some of the scenes. But he is...
It's not
this,
that broad, is it?
It's very broad. Yes, it is.
No.
But the Alfred Molina character is a real stick in the mud. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He doesn't want to do anything. He finds the idea of even just going out to eat in a restaurant too much of a stress. The idea of his daughter going to Paris with this guy, however, he seems to be able to talk himself into. And I thought we could have done with a little more examination of how it was that he seduced the parents. There are a couple of odd scenes where the girl comes downstairs to see David, the interloper, sitting, drinking and chatting with the parents. It's almost like he's inveigled his way into their little family life, and he's as much interested in that as he is in her.
We've got 4 minutes left in education. We'll continue the education correspondence, I think, next week, because I think it is a terrific film. Let's just mention that Michael Jackson's This Is It is out this week, with that special premiere you had.
Absolutely. So you will have heard, people will have heard of this. This is the film that's put together by Kenny Ortega, who directed the High School Musical films, and he was Michael Jackson's longtime choreographer. He was putting together the shows that were going to happen at the O2 before Michael Jackson died. They had hundreds of hours of footage that were filmed basically for Michael Jackson's viewing only. He wanted them to film him rehearsing so they could go back, watch it, and kind of perfect the routine, perfect the performance. And they've come up with a film that's about an hour and 50 minutes, which is mainly him doing these rehearsal performances. And I think we've got a clip now.
Get me out there. So right there. Mm-hmm. Into the nighttime. Four walls won't hold me tonight. If this town is just an apple, let me take a bite.
That's him singing there, Michael Jackson, and he sounds good. The incredible thing about this film for me is I was dreading it, absolutely dreading it. I mean, you know, I'm a fan of his greatest works, his classic pop songs, but you think, oh my God, what an exploitative thing to do, to come up with this film. And there's a huge campaign, some fans against it, there's This Is Not It campaign on the internet. If you Google it, you'll see a lot of people complaining about just the whole idea of this film. But for me, when you actually see it, the footage is incredible. He still had it. His dancing was brilliant. His voice was in fantastic form, as you can hear on that clip. And it's just actually fascinating to see him washing, being a perfectionist, putting together this show. And at the end of it, the really sad element of it is you come away thinking, actually, these shows at the Oto would have been pretty brilliant. And kind of they would have been an amazing comeback for someone who, let's face it, we hadn't seen perform properly for years and years and years. So I think the whole thing is absolutely justified. Obviously, it's going to make huge amounts of money for Sony. And, you know, in a way, it's you can understand people thinking it's dodgy. But the actual film, the actual footage is phenomenal, I think.
Nigel?
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I went in with about the lowest expectations, I think, that you could have. And I'm not a great Michael Jackson fan, although Billie Jean is a song I love. And interestingly enough, that's the one they build up to. That's the last big set-piece song. But you do get a sense, and in a way it's easy to forget, that beyond the tabloid headline, behind the sort of caressing of chimps and the alleged abusing of children and the taking of prescription drugs in huge quantities, there was a man who was a consummate entertainer and a great professional. And you see flashes of that here. It is a bit of a whitewash job, and it is very, very mawkish towards the end, I think. But of course, students of irony will love the fact that you see, for example, you see him singing the song that has the line, it doesn't matter if you're black or white, but you're seeing him in profile, looking very white indeed, having had a lot of de-racialization surgery, and in a sense betraying that line. And you kind of long for, you know, whatever happened to I'm black and I'm proud.
Yeah. It's not an objective documentary. It's not even really a documentary. It's just watching him perform.
Is it just for fans?
If you're not a fan, I wouldn't bother seeing it. If you're any kind of fan, you have to see it, because you will love it.
And it's not just on at 1 o'clock in the morning.
No, it's on. But it's only on for 2 weeks, apparently.
More conventional screenings are available.
Yeah, it's not the film of the week, though.
And that, which is?
An Education. It is 5 stars.
Nigel?
Yes, I would have to concede that.
You would concede that's the film of the week?
Yes.
An Education is movie of the week. Gentlemen, thanks very much indeed. Nigel Floyd, Boyd Hilton, thanks for all the correspondence. We'll keep all the emails on This Is It, and we'll get back to it again in a week's time.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.
Thanks for downloading this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. And if you like this, you might also like this.
Fighting Talk.
I want to know what the greatest winter sport is. Right, a bit of a cold snap in the studio today, actually. Let's just get Mark and Tom out of the way here. Mark?
I think ice hockey is a great sport. We've had it briefly mentioned by Greg. It's really underrated here, largely because our teams have all got stupid names, like Basingstoke Bison, for
Come
example.
On.
Or Nottingham Panthers.
For details of other 5 Live podcasts, go to the website bbc.co.uk/5live or go to the podcast directory in iTunes and search for 5 Live.